An institution is the length and shadow of one man. That's all it needs is the top of that. So the Navigators is really the extended shadow, the length and broadened shadow of one man, Dawson Trotman. Now I want to tell you why I think there is a Navigators today. And I want to quote from a British statesman, missionary statesman. Actually, he took over as the successor to Hudson Taylor, a director of the China Inland Mission. Now, this is British prose, and this sentence is kind of long. But after you've read it, we'll try to break it down into meaningful parts here. You can, how about, is that print too fine for you guys back in the back? Can you read that? Well, I got some finer print coming up, so you may have to move up later. But when God raises up a man for special service, he first works in that man the principles which later on are through his labors and influence to be a means of widespread blessing to the church and to the world. Now, I want to break that down to what I think he meant and see whether you agree with it or not. It seems to me what he's saying is when God gets ready to bless the church and the world through a principle, he first raises up a man to model that principle. Is that a fair explanation of what he's saying? So the Navigators is in existence today because God wanted to bless the church and the world through not new principles, but the resurrection of some principles. So as far as I'm concerned, that's the reason there is a Navigators today, that God wanted to bless the church and the world. Now, I'm going to try to make this presentation logically, build one step on the other. I don't know how logical I am. I have a grandson who, that's one of the courses he's taken in college, is logic. So the other day I said, well, let me give you a little problem here, and you tell me whether it's right or not. I said, in logic now, I understand that love is blind and that marriage is an institution. So therefore, marriage is an institution for the blind. Is that right? Well, I thought that was good logic. And he said, no, that's not good logic. I said, well, why isn't it? I said, well, you changed the meaning of words. So he was right on me there. But I'll try to make this a logical step by step. So that's the reason there is a Navigators. God wanted to bless the world through the resurrection of some principles. Now I have here a letter, a copy of a letter, that Dawson Trotman wrote when he was 21 years old to the president of the Dallas Theological Seminary. And you'll see as you unfold the letter. But what I want you to look for is what are some principles in his life that were real important at age 21. Now, I think I'll read this so that we can kind of follow at the same speed here. You'll see this is dated January 16, 1928. I'm writing to you for advice in a matter of much importance to me. I graduated from high school in June 1923, owing to the fact that I had little or no ambition in life, my education was sadly neglected. I've worked these 4.5 years, 2 in selling dry goods and furniture, and the remaining 2.5 years in a lumber yard. I'm now driving a Ross Carrier in a lumber yard, and I'm nearly 22. Anybody know what a Ross lumber carrier is? Yep. Well, it's kind of the predecessor to the forklift, except it was very high, 4 high wheels on it, had claws underneath in a lumber yard, so you could go over a stack of 2x4s or 2x8s, just put the fingers in, pick it up, and go. Now, since lumber yards are pretty crowded, it was built like a ferry boat, and it could go backwards or forwards, never turned around, just went backwards or forwards. So he ran one of those things for 2 or 3 years. Well, that showed up in his later life. When I first knew him, traffic wasn't as bad in Los Angeles as it is today. So when we'd go out and get in his car, he'd take a look to see, you know, which was the nearest corner. And if the nearest corner was behind, he would back to that intersection. Because he could drive a car backward just as accurately as he could bar it forward. So that's where he learned on the Ross Lumber Carrier. Then he says, about a year and a half ago, I was converted from a wild life. Drinking, gambling, thieving, lying, smoking, so forth, having had a part in my makeup. I'm now saved by grace, and I have had victory in overcoming all of these wild habits. Perhaps one of the most rotten dispositions, also having been defeated through the power of Jesus Christ. I've been the president of one of the liveliest Christian Endeavor societies for a year and have spent many precious moments in service for Him. I've preached 2 sermons and have given many talks and am not afraid to stand out anywhere and preach the gospel. My happiest moments are spent in dealing with men, boys, and girls about Jesus Christ. As a fisherman, Matthew 4:19, I've won 2 souls to Christ. I say this only that you might know the little experience I've had. I love to pray. Having had real burdens and delight in reading God's Word, I've memorized 10 chapters of the Bible and can quote about 120 passages, being able to tell where they are. I memorize while I work. Having set my goal for souls high, I must do big things for the Master, and I look to you as having had practical experience for advice as to preparation, realizing my utter inability to do anything but by Him and through Him. Expository preaching holds much attraction to me. Thank you kindly for your service. And he goes on, I'm just beginning a course in better English with the International Correspondence Schools, and that probably includes spelling, which he misspelled a few words in here, if you can see. Well, what was really motivating this young guy at 21? What were some of the things? Tell me. You can see from that letter.
Scripture memory.
Scripture memory. Hot on it. Memorized 10 chapters. 120 verses. Yeah. What else?
Praying.
Okay. What else?
Sharing the gospel.
Okay. These are pretty important, aren't they? And wasn't afraid to stand out any place, preach the gospel. Well, when God got ready to bless the church and the world through some principles, He got the right man. Don't you think? In there? Because already, at age 21, he was really strong in these areas. So as I said, I think that's the reason there's a Navigator ministry today. Now, I've got the latest scoop sheet on the Navigators. This is dated 10th of February this year, so that's pretty recent, isn't it? Right now, this summary says we have 3,882 staff worldwide. And I just highlighted 2 or 3 facts on here. Those that haven't been around the Navigators a lot and don't know the Navigators a lot, you'll meet 6 or 8 staff this week. Well, they're not typical of the other 2,300 we've got. They're better than the other 2,300. But then we have some of the same mold as some that you'll meet. In the U.S., overseas, there are South Korea has 144, Canada 142, Indonesia 134, East Asia, which is the euphemism for China, 108, Australia 95, Great Britain 94, and so forth. So what started with this one man has now expanded to, as of February this year, that's some of the look of the Navigator ministry. 107 countries have a Navigator ministry of some kind. And they're all doing what God raised up Dawson Trotman to model. Now, he put together these things in the form of an illustration. And I've got an early copy of it here. How many of you here have read the book, DOS? Well, quite a few of you. So some of these pictures and things that I'll show are familiar to you. Now, you remember in there it's described how that his mentor, as an early Christian, was a pastor, Presbyterian pastor named Vernon Morgan. And he and Morgan were a lot alike. Morgan had figured out what he thought were the basics of the Christian life. And these were the Word, prayer, and witnessing, which is the same thing you picked out of his letter here this morning. So in order to illustrate these, Morgan used an illustration that was appropriate then when instead of having any milk delivered to your door, everybody had a milk cow. And I don't know why they designed a milk stool like this, but everybody had a dairy cow, had a milk stool, which was like a 2x8 with three legs on it. And they were slanted like this. So in order to stay on that stool without tipping over, you had to be perfectly balanced on all three. So Morgan said, yeah, those are the three things. The chief perfect balance is the Word, prayer, and witnessing. But Dawson Trotman didn't like that illustration. Two things wrong with it. First of all, he didn't like the idea of illustrating the Christian life sitting down. And then the other thing was, he said, I know a lot of Christians who are in the Word, who witness, who pray, but he said they have such a sour disposition. They turn everybody off. He said there must be another element. So he used Colossians 3:23 to illustrate this other element. And in addition to the Word, prayer, and witnessing, he called this, spoke, living the life. Now, this illustration has been updated several times. And in our workbook or program, you've got an up-to-date copy of the wheel illustrations that exists today. But Colossians 3:23 says, whatsoever you do, do it heartily, as unto the Lord and not unto men. As a young Christian, Dawson Trotman saw the value of teamwork, and he realized he couldn't do anything without a team. So he put together several teams, and he laid on them the same disciplines that he practiced. One of his early groups was called the Minutemen. And I have a record, I think this is printed in DOS also, of their meeting held August 28, 1932. So as they met, they were discussing their duties, their job description, I guess. And here's what they had down as their duties. One, memorize a verse a day. Two, have an hour a day with the Lord. Three, touch a life a day. Four, have a definite work to do each week. Keep a journal. Have ammunition ready. He meant always having a tract or a Gospel of John. Have team business up to date. Read 2 hours a week. Tackle own task. I think there's a duplication between four and nine here because he always wanted somebody to have a project. I think we call that staff development or personal development today. So according to the minutes of this meeting, they discussed these duties, and apparently some of them thought they were a little heavy. So the next time they met, September 4th, he said three more duties were added. And these three were, memorize a half a hymn a week, review seven verses a day, spend some definite time on our filing system. He was a very orderly person. I don't know what kind of a filing system you use, but somebody recommended the Hunt system to me. And I found out that works very effectively, so that's what I use the most, is the Hunt system. But as he began to lay these disciplines on the other guys, they weren't as motivated as he was. And I think it was summed up by Dr. Bob Munger, in his dedicatory address to Glen Eyrie. He knew the Navigators quite a bit, and he wanted to preach us a little sermon there when he dedicated the Glen. So one of the remarks he made was that discipline without desire is drudgery. And I expect that all of us can identify with the truth of that statement. Well, he laid it on so heavy that one by one, they bailed out on him. They didn't have a team. They wouldn't respond to the same discipline that he did. So he took one of the guys that he thought was the most responsive, Walt Stanton, and said, we got to pray about these guys. You know, would you join me for a time of extended prayer? And Walt said, yes, sir, I'll be glad to join you. So Dawson said, I'll pick you up at 3:30 in the morning. And Walt thought he said 3:30 in the morning. It turned out he said 3:30 in the morning. So he picked him up on his motorcycle. And they went down to a little canyon near Lomita. And several years ago, one of our reps out there said, we'd like to have another prayer meeting at that canyon where these two guys met. So they located, we went down there, and the Torrance City Airport is right on top of it. And there's a trailer park right on the level part. So you wind your way through this trailer park, and you can find this little canyon where it can't be built. We tried to have a prayer meeting, but the airplanes take it off of that airport all the time, made it so you couldn't even hear one another talk. So it's not a real sacred shrine today where they had that prayer meeting. But they began to pray for the other guys on the team. Well, they didn't set a time for the length of the prayer meeting, but you know, they agreed to pray, I guess, till they felt they'd prayed enough. Now, I don't know, well, by the way, they prayed from 4 to 6 every morning. And on Sunday, they slept until 6, well, until 5:30, and then prayed from 6 to 10. So they 2 hours every day, 4 hours on Sunday. Now, I don't know how many two-hour prayer meetings you've been in, but you can cover a lot of ground in 2 hours. In fact, they were just praying for 5 or 6 people. And within a few days, they had prayed not once but several times everything they could think for these other guys on the team. You think that's the way it would work out? You know, 2 hours, you concentrate? So having saturated these guys thoroughly, they said, well, we know some other people. Besides the men on this team, they're just like them. Now, by the way, your exposure to the Navigators, you've probably found that there are various classifications of Christians in their growth. But Dawson Troutman only had two classifications. And that was, you're either down to business or not down to business. So the only prayer he would make for a guy, he'd get out of business. And then he'd name some areas in which he needed to get out of business. So they said, we know some other people that are not down to business. So they're going to pray for them. And within a few days, they had saturated everybody they knew very thoroughly in prayer. And they said, well, we bet there's guys that we don't even know in San Francisco and Oakland and Seattle and Phoenix. So they're going to pray for them, people they didn't know. And they expanded out and covered for all 48 of the 48 states then. And states and cities, but the burden didn't lift. And the last few days of that six-week prayer meeting, they took a map of the world and put in the rocks and put their finger on various countries and cities and prayed that God would raise up some down-to-business men and women in those cities. This was before I met Dawson Troutman. I asked him once about this. I said, you remember specifically, you know, what countries and cities you prayed for? He said, well, I remember most of them, and he named a few of them, but he didn't even remember all of them. But those of us that travel in Navigator Ministry today have got a pretty good idea of some of those countries they prayed for, because we have a Navigator presence in 107 of them today. Okay, then chronologically in his life, after this prayer meeting, Dawson took some time out to get married, and he attended a year in two Bible schools, Bible Institute of Los Angeles and a Baptist Theological Seminary. And then, he had a classmate in Bible Institute of Los Angeles, the name of Helen Rittenhouse. She and her mother lived in San Diego, California. And on Sunday mornings, they would go to the Baptist church and pick out some of the recruits that were in there and thought they must have some spiritual motivation that wouldn't come to church. So they'd invite them out to their house and give them a good home-cooked meal. Then they have Bible studies in the afternoon. So among these guys they invited over to their house was a young fellow named Lester Spencer. And Helen was so impressed by him that she said, "Now, when you get up to Long Beach, go in the fleet, you need to look up Dawson Trotman." And she also wrote Dawson Trotman, "Now, when this guy comes, you look him up." Well, I'd like to ask you a question. Who do you think looked up who or whom? Well, Spencer didn't look up Trotman. Now, would you like to hear firsthand Spencer's account of that meeting? Like to hear that? I've got it on tape here. Okay, I'll give you his account, then I'll give you a couple other accounts that exist. Yeah, we're going to have to, we just got one power source here, so.
That isn't longer, and we're going to have about 8 minutes each for the eight of us. To go to Sunday school and church. So I was saved when I went into the service and began to realize that God had a purpose for my life.
This is Spencer.
It came time for me to be transferred to the fleet. I didn't request an assignment at all.
Loud enough?
And I just committed it to the Lord. I said, "You send me where I belong." And you know the story that I was sent to the USS West Virginia up in San Pedro Harbor. And with that move, I was within 5 miles of Dawson Trotman. Very interesting how it all worked out geographically. And Helen and Dawson were in Biola together. And when I went to San Pedro, Helen wrote Doss and said, "Look him up. Look me up, that I need help." And that's right. And as you probably know also, it was Doss's habit, before he went to work every morning, he would set aside a little time to go up in the Palo Verde Hill, north of San Pedro, and spend some time with the Lord. And he was very organized, had his little book, and my name was on one of those pages. I don't know how it was now, sooner or later. But anyway, on that particular morning, my name was on the page the doc was dealing with. So he said, "I've got to look that fellow up." So quickly he closed up his book, got in his car,
thank you,
and headed towards Trona Field. Any of you know about Trona Field? Yeah. Installation there of the Navy and communications there. So Doc rushed down to Trona Field and sent a radiogram to me on the West Virginia. And the message read something like this: "They meet me at the dock at 4 o'clock. I'll be wearing a light coat, dark trousers, pants, shoes, socks, and socks." Now, he had given the name of Rittenhouse originally for that message to be included in that message, but that hadn't gotten in there. So, about 8:30, I was cleaning up the dishes. I was best cooking, yeah. Hadn't been on the ship too long.
Okay.
And a fellow from Topside, whose name was Spencer, I hadn't met him, came and handed me this message. He said, is your name, first name Lester? I said, yes. He said, well, then this must be for you. So I stopped long enough to read it, and I just sort of shook my head. As you know, there's all kind of con games to separate a serviceman from his money. And I thought, something's going on here like that. So I just folded it, put it in my little pocket there in my hood. But all day long, I was going to ignore it. All day long, the Lord didn't let me forget it, though. I said, how did you get my name? What in the world did you have any contact with me? So that just kept bugging me. So I got someone to take care of the evening meal, and I said, well, I'll go over and see what this is all about. But I left all my money aboard except 25 cents for a water pack to home. So I was there a little bit before four, and after a while, amongst all those blue uniforms, I saw a civilian. And he was looking around. I thought, well, it must be the man. So I went over to him, and I said, are you Trotman? Yes. Are you Spencer? Yes. And then he told me who he was and what it was all about. And then he said, how'd you like to go home with me tonight to a chicken dinner? And you know my response. And he said, I called Lyle after I sent that message, and she prepared a chicken dinner for us. Remember that, Lyle? So before long, we arrived at his home, a lovely time, lovely dinner, and then Doc said, let's go and have a little fellowship around the Word. Fine. He had a Chevy, two-door coupe. We got in that car and wound our way up the hills there, and came to a place in the road that was wide enough for a car to pull out and park. And I learned later that this was Lover's Lane. That's why the policeman was a little suspicious. But we had settled in there, was reading the scriptures off the reading. He had turned on the little light above. And I was on the passenger side. All of a sudden, there was a knock on the window right by me. And I looked up, and here was a policeman with a big star. And he knocked again, and I rolled down the window. He said, what are you guys doing here? And one of the things that I always admired in God, he was always quick on the trigger. And he said, well, sir, we're reading the Bible. Is that all right? And you can see amazement written all over his face. there was a moment of silence, and Doc picked it up with my cap. He said, well, he said, if you don't believe it, he told us that he was a guard at a school with a big laurel head, about 20 feet high there. And he told us that he was a guard for that school. And Doc said, well, if you don't believe it, if you just go in and unlock one of those school rooms, turn on the light, and we'll prove it to you. And so he said, okay. So he led us down into the school room, turned on the light, and Doc began to deal with it. And the thing that I guess that impressed me most about that whole thing was the Bunch's knowledge of the Word and his skill in using it. This fellow brought up all kinds of questions, and Doc didn't argue with him at all. And he had the ladder on his Bible, and he flipped that over many times right to the page. And he'd say, sir, would you read this, please? The fellow would read. And then he'd bring up something else. And this happened for about 20 minutes. And finally, the fellow had nothing more to say. And so Doc pressed him then for a decision. And he said, well, not now. I'm not ready. So we went on our way up the path, and I was so amazed. I'd never seen anybody handle the Bible like that before. And I said to him as we walked out, I said, Doc, that was great. And I said, you know, I'd give a right arm if I could do that. And he says, oh, no, you wouldn't. You see, he was joking with me. And he was really setting me up for something he had in mind. I'd already been prepared because of experience on the ship. You know, I want to take you ashore and get you into all kinds of troubles, and I wouldn't go. And this happened two or three times. And finally, this one fellow said, well, you don't go with us. You think you're too good for us? And I said, no, I don't think I'm too good for you, but said, I'm a Christian and I don't do those things. And we were in the compartment there, and several of the guys around. And he let out a yell, and he says, hey, guys, come on over here. We've got a real live one. You know, and then it started. About six or seven of them. Rick King did his wife. And all these things that I didn't know anything about. And I felt so bad because I just felt I was letting the Lord down. And I...
58 minutes in that tape, isn't there, Fred, the whole thing there? But those are the highlights. This is what he looked like as a young man. He's the only one of the original four Dawson Troutman met with that's alive today. He celebrated his 90th birthday last August, and I talked to him on the phone occasionally. And his wife says he sleeps a little more than he used to. And has a little trouble remembering. But outside of that, he's fine and in great shape. I came aboard the battleship West Virginia about 6 months before he did. And when I got in the Navy, I wanted to succeed. I enlisted in 1932. I tried to figure out the system, and I figured it out pretty soon. And that was if... you go to work 5 minutes before anybody else and stay 5 minutes after everybody else has left, you'll soon be in charge of the operation. So I applied that principle, and as a very low-ranking seaman, I had a minor supervisory position of about 75 people, and one of them was Lester Spencer. So I saw him three times a day and inspected his work. And one day he showed up with a black eye. And I said to him, now, if you'd stay out of the bars, you wouldn't get beat up. And he said, I didn't get that in the bar. I got that playing football. He said, I'm a Christian. Well, Dawson Troutman was just teaching him to be bold in his witness. A few days later, when he came by for me to check his work, my mother gave me a Bible my first Christmas home in the Navy. She never told me what to do with it. I thought it was a good luck charm, so I kept it in my locker. And I always had a few extra dollars that other people didn't have. So my friends would often want to borrow some, so I kept my loose money in my Bible. Figured nobody would ever look for it in there. So one day a man came by and wanted to borrow some money, so I took out my Bible, and Spencer saw me do that. And he told me, he said, you know, that Bible's good for something else. It's better to keep your money in. So he kept on me, and within a few months, he got me to go over to visit Dawson and Lila Troutman. Then that was December 1933. They lived in a second floor apartment in San Pedro, small apartment. So I went over with Lester in the afternoon and spent a little time in athletics, and Dawson Troutman talked to me. Had dinner, and then had a little meeting of about six or eight people, and started off with singing some hymns and choruses. Well, if you can remember back to your non-Christian days, why, you can remember how much you enjoyed being in a meeting where they were singing Christian hymns and choruses, and I felt trapped in there and was looking for a way to get out. Well, about that time, there was a knock on the door, and it was the neighbors. And they said, if you don't knock off that noise, we're going to call the police. But Dawson exercised his First Amendment rights, and the next knock on the door was the police. And here I had a clean record in the Navy, and I thought, what am I getting into? You know, go to jail. These so-called Christians end up in jail. So I said, when the meeting was over, I got to get back to the ship. And they told me, well, the last boat's left. You know, no more boats going back. And I said, well, I want to go back anyway. So I slept on a bench on the pier that night just to get out of that situation that it was in. So that was my introduction to Dawson and Lalo Trotman and the Navigators. But within a year and a half, I got over it, and through the influence of Lester and the ones who succeeded him, well, I did become a Christian. Now, I probably gave it the wrong order here, because I gave you the great stoop first, but I think you should be familiar with this account that appeared in Time magazine a couple weeks after Dawson Trotman's death. Now, is that can you read that fine print all the way back there? Oh, okay, I didn't think you could. I told you had some fine print. Okay, I'll read part of it to you then. Is that okay? This is telling about his drowning. And it says here, memorizing the Bible was the key to conversion as Trotman saw it, so he handed out scores of scriptures to youth groups he organized. One day in 1934, a mother asked him to look up her son, a sailor, on a ship off Long Beach. So reporters don't always get everything straight, you know, so it wasn't a mother that asked him to look it up, it was Helen Rittenhouse. Sitting in his old car by the waterfront. Well, they weren't the waterfront. They were up over the waterfront in the Palisades there, San Pedro. Trotman quoted the Bible to the boy until a policeman grew suspicious. Well, you can see how they miss it in that. Now, actually, there's one thing that skipped Les's memory in that account, in this account he gave. And I got this directly from Dawson Trotman. When the policeman came up to the door, this was during the days of Prohibition, he said, okay, guys, where's the bottle? And if you remember those days, or have heard about those days, you know that the law enforcement officers were often looking for a free drink rather than try to enforce the law. I read an account in the paper back in those days about the Chicago gangster that left a wife and seven policemen to support when he was shot. But that's the question he asked him, was, you know, where's the bottle? And that's when Dawson said, we don't have a bottle, we have a Bible. And then Les picked it up from there. So the Time magazine said a few minutes later, Trotman had talked the cop into joining him and the sailor in a session of prayer. Well, that's not quite what Lester said either, was it? The sailor said, I'd give my right arm if I could do what you've just did. Dawson challenged him to try. Then Time said it was the beginning of a movement that Trotman called the Navigators for its nautical origins and so forth. But how many of you here have been to Glen Eyrie? Well, several. Well, you probably appreciate this last paragraph in the Time article then. He said, but Dawson Trotman did not rest. Here's the sentence I want. In 1953, Trotman bought a large, luxurious ranch at Colorado Springs and turned it into a national headquarters and free vacation spot for navigators. Well, I have a great respect for journalists and journalism, but somehow they just don't seem to get all the facts exactly as they are. Well, for the first time, Dawson Trotman found a man that bought everything he stood for, hook, line, and sinker. First man he'd ever met, bought the whole package. Well, it wasn't long until Spencer had contacted another man. Now, the situation was very much the same. Lester didn't mention his testimony, but in those days, there was no GI Bill or college loan program. If you had the money to go to college, you could go. If you didn't have the money, you couldn't. It was just that simple. So Lester joined the Navy to save money to go to college and seminary and become a pastor. Well, he met this friend, Gurney Harris, who came in the Navy for the same reason. And that was to save money, go to college and seminary, and become a pastor. So he took him over to Dawson Trotman and said, now, here's a man that needs what you've been giving me even worse than I did. And so Dawson Trotman almost took him. And then he said, what's wrong with you teaching it? And Spencer said, oh, I could never do that. I've got this on videotape also, Spencer's account of that. And but Dawson Trotman was serious. And he said, if you can't teach him what I've taught you, I'm a failure as a teacher. Now, I'm going to start all over again with you and stick with you until you can teach him what I taught you. The navigators began to spread out, mostly in the fleet. And according to this same Time article, which does have one accurate thing in there, by the end of World War II, there were navigators that had more than 1,000 military addresses. A man who ran the navigator home in Honolulu was an ex-CPA by the name of Harold DeGroff. And we were having a reunion a few years ago, and I asked Harold, who's about 93 or 4, I said, do you have any records of the guys that came to your home that we might use for a reunion? He said, oh, yes, I've kept one. I kept a record of everybody that came. They had to sign a sheet. And I said, well, could I have a few of them? It might be some of the guys still live at these addresses. He said, well, there's quite a few of them. I said, what do you mean by quite a few? He said, well, there's over 25,000. And he said, now, some of them might have signed more than once. You know, very modest there, duplication. But he had this whole box full of more than 25,000 people that visited his home in the 9 years he was in Honolulu. Now, I want to jump ahead and then come back to some war stories here. I've heard it said, and I'm sure you have too, that there are three kinds of statistics. Three kinds of lies, rather. I think I've already given away the punchline. There are white lies, black lies, and statistics. Now, that looks kind of mysterious, but I just want to point out a couple of things here. The first is that between 1950 and 1980, the population of the world more than doubled in that 40-year period. Now, the next thing, that the number of Christians, people who claim to be Christians, do not claim, people who claim to be Christians, in that 40 years went from 854 million to 1,433,000,000, which is almost doubled during that time, that 40-year period. Population of the world more than doubled, Christian population almost more than doubled. But missiologists have a category of people that they call Great Commission Christians. Is a new phase being employed by the task force to refer to those believers who take seriously the Great Commission. Now let's look at them. Their number increased from 80 million to 275 million during that same 40 years. That's over a 600% increase. The number of missionaries, evangelical missionaries on the field, grew from about 18,000 to more than 150,000 today. Now, Roy Robertson's doing another movement in missions, came out of World War II, and the navigators were at the head of that thrust. So that period of the guys in the fleet that grew out of Trotman's contact with Spencer, so forth, contributed greatly to the most significant thrust in missionary activity that's ever existed in history. Now, if you want to read some more of the details of that period, there's a book on the book table called Valiant in Fight, and it's written mainly about the guys on the West Virginia. But and John's a real pusher of the book, and there's quite a few of them over on the table. Yes?
Isn't it true that Trotman had a lot to do with Bill Bright getting started?
Yes. I was down at Expo 72 that Bill had down at Dallas. I was in the same group that he was in. So he told me things I never knew. He said, I started to work evangelizing on UCLA. And he said, I didn't know what to do with new Christians. So every Saturday morning, I would take the new Christians over to Dawson Trotman. And he said he taught me movement in missions came out of World War II. And the navigators were at the head of that thrust. So that period of the guys in the fleet that grew out of Trotman's contact with Spencer, so forth, contributed greatly to the most significant thrust in missionary activity that's ever existed in history. Now, if you want to read some more of the details of that period, there's a book on the book table called Valiant in Fight. And it's written mainly about the guys on the West Virginia. But and John's a real pusher of the book, and there's quite a few of them over on the table. Yes?
Isn't it true that Trotman had a lot to do with Bill Bright getting started?
Yes. I was down at Expo 72 that Bill had down at Dallas. I was in the same group that he was in. So he told me things I never knew. He said, I started to work evangelizing on UCLA. And he said, I didn't know what to do with new Christians. So every Saturday morning, I would take the new Christians over to Dawson Trotman. And he said he taught me all that I know about disciple making and follow-up. He was already an evangelist. But, yeah, he would say that Dawson Trotman had as much or more influence in his life than anybody else. Now, Mr. Mayor, since you've asked that question, why, I'll add something to it that I intend to put a little bit later. I give presentations like this quite often, and a question that comes up is, how about the navigators and Billy Graham? How'd they get hooked up with Billy Graham? So I think I'll work that in here, too. But one of the guys who headed up a ministry on the battleship Mississippi, a man by the name of John Streeter, and after he got out of service, he went to Wheaton College. And to help pay his way, he had a pickup truck. And so he would do handyman work, you know, light loads. And the guy he employed as his helper was Billy Graham, who was another student at Wheaton College. So sometimes Billy has John on his program. He introduced him as his former boss. So he was a muscle man for John, who ran this pickup. Now, one day when Dawson Trotman was visiting John Streeter at Wheaton College, he introduced him to Billy Graham. And we've got a tape of this where that he said Dawson Trotman looked him in the eye, held out his hand, made him feel like he's the most important person in the world. And he said, what did God say to you in your quiet time this morning? And Billy said, I was embarrassed, because I hadn't had a quiet time that morning. So that was their introduction. Well, then after Billy graduated from college, he joined up with Youth for Christ. And Dawson Trotman was on the board of Youth for Christ. So they furthered their acquaintance. William B. Riley, an outstanding Christian of another generation, founded a school up in St. Paul called the Northwestern Schools. And he was looking for somebody to take over that he thought would be true to why the school was founded. So he persuaded Billy Graham to become the president of Northwestern Schools. Well, Billy invited Dawson Trotman to come up and speak at chapel. You know, he knew him from his connection with Youth for Christ. So Dawson said, how much time would I have? He said, well, 20 minutes. We might stretch it to 25. And Dawson said, if you'll give me an hour a day for a week, I'll come. So he did. And he gave him the things that he thought was important, these basic truths. So as a result of that, Billy incorporated that into the curriculum of Northwestern Schools, the Bible school. And the things that we teach as navigators today were part of the curriculum. We got 28 staff members out of that class, including people like Leroy Iams and Walden Scott, and some of the names that some of the old-timers will recognize. Well, then when Billy saw that God was going to bless him as evangelist, he made a study and found out that the downfall of most evangelists was the lack of follow-up and the way they handle money. So he determined there would be proper follow-up. So he knew Dawson Trotman from these contacts he had had, both with Youth for Christ and Northwestern School, so he recruited him to set up his follow-up program. So I just throw that in. You know, that's what he got acquainted with Billy Graham. Now the time is moving on here, isn't it? Oh, we got plenty of time. I'll tell you a couple of war stories here if I can work them in. Is that okay here? Us guys in the fleet, I think that we got kind of arrogant and felt probably that the U.S. Navy existed for our convenience. And if we wanted to go someplace, we'd just pray that the ship would go to that place and it would go. And if we didn't like a chaplain, we'd pray that God would move him or convert him so he'd get moved in there. But the West Virginia, where Lester was and where I was, where it all got started, we'd graduate a class every 4 years. The Navy then had a practice that if you had re-enlist, you could choose any ship in the Navy. So we'd get these guys built up during their time, then they could choose any ship in the Navy to re-enlist. So one of the fellows that was on our team was a fellow named John Prince. And he wasn't the most tactful evangelist in his younger days and turned off a few people. But we sent him to the battleship Idaho. And the day he arrived, he was a radioman by trade. He met one of these fellows that he had really turned off on the West Virginia. Name was Alvin Abel. And he said, if you open your mouth preaching on this ship, and he threatened him. I don't know what he threatened him with, but a pretty bad threat. So John Prince, when he told me about this, he said, you know, I really shudder to think what I prayed. He said, I prayed, God, ask you'll either convert him or remove him. Now, people been around the Navigators for a while know the name Cecil Davidson. Cecil Davidson was also a radioman aboard the Idaho. And he gave me one day a page out of his diary. And he tells about what he was doing in the day. And then he copied a message. He said, went on watch after chow, copied on the bottom line. And this is a message that he copied. A.W. Abel, Seaman Second, died of unknown causes on the Long Beach Pike. That was the message he wrote down. This was the guy that threatened Prince. And as I understand, that in his death certificate, the cause of death was listed as unknown. So Prince went on to have pretty good ministry on that ship. He felt called and confirmed that God had taken this man out of the way. So we had a few experiences like this that made us feel like that the Navy was kind of under God's control and operated for our convenience. Some of the people on the ship gave us a bad time, but the senior officers mostly didn't. And one captain told us once, he said, I figure if we ever get in a real problem, that God's going to take care of you guys. And I go along for the ride. I met a man, missionary statesman, a few months ago, and he said, Jim, I better get a story to tell that you've never heard. And I said, well, you probably do. Tell me about it. He said, I lived in Pasadena in 1939 and 40, back in that period, and I was in Dawson Trotman's Bible study. And I've traveled with him quite a bit, went every place he went. So one day we were out on a trip, and we met a fellow I'd known before, and he said to me, "Don, what are you doing now?" And Don said, "I'm a navigator." And they went on their way, and pretty soon Dawson said to him, "Don, did I hear you say you're a navigator?" And he said, "Yes." And Dawson said, "What makes you think you're a navigator?" He said, "Well, I'm in your Bible study. I'm on your ministry team. I travel with you about half time." And Dawson said, "You're no navigator." Well, you can imagine how deflated Don was. He says, "What do you mean?" So Dawson asked him this question. "Where are your spiritual grandchildren?" Pretty clear to him what the navigators were all about. I made a career out of the Navy, and as I traveled around port to port, he would always ask me, or home base to home base, to be the navigator representative. So I asked him once, when he asked me if my ship was based in Honolulu, he said, "Will you be the nav rep there?" And I said, "Well, I don't understand everything I see coming out in print from headquarters these days. I think maybe the navigators are changing. What would I be expected to do as a navigator representative?" And he said, "Well, you know what to do." I said, "Well, I want to hear you say it." And finally got him to say it. He said, "Do what you've always done. Lead people to Christ and build them up to where they can repeat the process." So the navigator ministry was never any more complicated to Dawson Trotman than that. What do? Lead people to Christ, build them up so they can repeat the process. And he wanted to see not just converts, but where are your spiritual grandchildren? He didn't care how many people Don led to Christ. How many have they led to Christ? A generational thing. Now, I've mixed up my notes, and we want to leave 5 minutes. There's an evaluation sheet that the conference wants. They want to know what workshops you repeat year to year. So what you think of this workshop will depend on whether it's repeated next year or not, probably. So we'll come to that in a little bit. But in the meantime, any questions or comments anyone has? Yeah.
At what point did the name navigators begin to attach?
Okay, real great question. Glad you asked that. Dawson Trotman had a boys' club at one time. He called the Navigators just because he thought it was a catchy name. You know, he didn't know what it meant. But of the first four guys that he worked with, one of them was a radioman named John Dedrick. And John was a very ambitious man, and in addition to his own profession, he was studying celestial navigation. So in order for Dawson Trotman to get time with him, he said, "Would you teach me how to do celestial navigation?" So he taught him how to take star sights and how to use a sextant and tables and all that, you know, to find out where you were. And Dawson was fascinated with this science, you know, of celestial navigation. And he said, "Well, everybody's navigating on the Sea of Life. And unless they have the right chart, compass, and instruments, they won't find their way where they're going." So he said, "Spiritual navigation, that's what life's all about." So in 1935, they began calling what had been called just a serviceman's Bible study the Navigators, as a result of his exposure to celestial navigation. Okay, that was a great question. Any others?
Where were you when Pearl Harbor hit?
I was stationed aboard the battleship West Virginia then. And fortunately, I was off the ship and missed the first 20 minutes of the attack. But the next 2 hours and 40 minutes, I was aboard ship for the attack until the last Japanese plane had flown over. Now, the West Virginia, we took 8 torpedoes and 2 2,000-pound bombs. And Pearl Harbor is a shallow harbor, about 40 feet deepest. A battleship draws 34 feet, so it's only 6 feet of water under, so they settle down in the mud. And at quite a bad angle. But those eight torpedoes knocked out all of our power, and about all I could do was try to cool off ammunition, keep it from exploding, and then you're always aware of a body, you know, whether it's alive or whether it's dead, so that's very distracting. So we lost 105 that morning on my ship. So between trying to keep ammunition from exploding and tending to the wounded, and so I went around the ship. I was the postmaster on the ship at that time. I knew most everybody by name. So I'd pick up see a body and somebody I knew. I just make a mental note, I'm going to raise parents, because nobody else will ever tell them what happened to him. So that's what I did during the rest of it. But there's been a lot of interest in Pearl Harbor since September 11. And I get requests to speak just on Pearl Harbor, almost weekly. I was up at Iowa State, and they use it for evangelism, you know, speaking to the students' fraternity and students on Pearl Harbor, using evangelism. I'll be at Minot State University week after next for the same thing up there. So I'm glad you asked that question, because there's a lot of interest and not too many of us left that were there. By the way, I'm 88, coming up on 89. I'll be 89 in August if I make it till then. Yes.
Is there any reason to think that Navigator's method is more or less effective today than it was back in the 30s?
Where that the Navigator principles are practiced, they're just as effective or more. I find that these guys aboard ship were they were what Dawson Robin called down to business. Kind of hard to get students or even military people today to memorize scripture and study the Bible. We've got some interesting examples of that. We had one guy on the destroyer, and he was a watchstander. That's all he did. He was 4 hours on, 8 off. So he spent 8 hours a day reading the Bible for the first year as a Christian. Had the time to do it. So we were in an atmosphere. But my only thing is that I don't think there are people practicing these Navigator principles with the same diligence and heart that we saw back in the fleet in those days. I could be wrong in that.
Yeah. I've heard you say that you felt like the Navy ship was one of the best laboratories, or the best laboratories, for making disciples. And why do you think that was?
Well, I'll have to tell you what life was like on a battleship in those days. That there was no radio. There were no newspapers. There were no magazines. Once you went over the horizon, it was like going to a black hole in time. And you were totally out of contact with the world until you came back in port again. Now, the day on a battleship, if you weren't in strenuous maneuvers, get up at 5:30, work till 7:30, have breakfast, then work 8 to 3:30. And you've got a 3:30 to 5:30, then take care of personal items. If the weather permits and there are not too strenuous maneuvers, there's a movie shown on the fantail of the ship every day at 7 o'clock. And everybody that isn't on watch would be back to the movie at 7 o'clock. So our team used the 6 o'clock to 7:30 to evangelize. We fanned out over the ship every night, all of us, 8 or 10 of us, you know, about 1,500 people on the ship. So that was just our way of life. Then when everybody had gone to the movies, we met as a team for Bible study and prayer for 2.5 hours every night, 5 nights a week. Would you like to be a part of a group like that? You could spend that? So we had 1.5 hours to evangelize every day, and then 2.5 hours with each other in that. And on the weekends, we varied our program a little bit if we were at sea. But that's the reason I think it's about the nearest perfect laboratory that you could find was a battleship. And I don't think you can duplicate that today, because with satellites on the ship, you know, it's almost like you're not out of touch with shore, email and all that stuff. But the nearer we can duplicate that atmosphere, I think the more effective we'll be. Okay, that's a good question. Anybody else have one? What time does this workshop be over, Fred? I forgot on that.
Oh, 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
25 minutes.
5 to 11 is that when it's over? I looked, but I forgot here. I'm 8 to 9.
We've got 20 minutes.
Okay.
I have another question. In that time, did the general public or other guys on the ship, in this case, view you as a radical group? Were you accepted, or were you considered a roving band of radicals?
Man, what great questions we've got.
Well, and really, there's, I guess I'd preface the question by stating that if we would really go out like that today, I think we would be viewed as radicals. And so, which is not a bad thing. But I was just curious to know how you guys were accepted in that day.
Okay, I left a part out of my presentation that comments on that. And I've got an article here someplace. Looking through here, I got my stuff out of order. That in the late 30s, Congress, the whole nation was very pacifistic. And the first year I was in the Navy, Congress refused to appropriate money to buy fuel. So we stayed at anchor for a whole year in the 30s. Admiral Yarnell, who was commander-in-chief of the Asiatic Fleet, knew the Japanese were fortifying the islands they'd gotten from the Germans in World War I. So he asked in his budget $5 million to update the airbase on Guam. Two senators and two congressmen introduced a resolution asking the Secretary of Navy to court-martial him for being a warmonger. Now, that was the kind of state of mind. So the Navy decided to go directly to the public. So they invited 20 of the outstanding reporters in the U.S. to take a tour of the Pacific at their expense, hoping they would write something that would stir up the public. One of these guys was Walter Davenport, who was the political editor of Collier's Magazine. Now, none of you remember Collier's Magazine, but it was the Time magazine of those days, and not, it was sold on the street corners for a nickel, but it was the most widely read magazine. So Walter Davenport came out to San Francisco, went aboard the battleship California to ride it to Hawaii, where he was going to take a plane to tour the South Pacific. So the Navy waited, you know, to see the first article he was going to write that would help the Navy get money, you know, do their job. So the Navy was kind of shocked, and so were the navigators, when the article that he wrote was called Onward Christian Sailors. And there's a picture of Dawson Trotman in that article. Well, in the text, I'll just read a paragraph or two, and that'll comment on that. That he went aboard the California on Sunday night, and his escort was what we call a chief master at arms, chief of police. His name was Murphy. And he was explaining to Mr. Davenport, you know, what the Navy is all about. And here's his own account in the article. He said, "We just grabbed Mr. Murphy's arm, interrupting him. Gobs or gentlemen, we had seen something. Four sailors, trim as new sleuth, but with their faces set in green lines, were about to go ashore in a body. Under their arms, clamped tight to their ribs, they carried Bibles. Just before they descended into the boat, one of them, a little taller than the others, paused. We'd guess he was about 25 years old, had a hawk face, wide shoulders, big hairy hands, and one glance told you it would be very bad judgment indeed to ask him to step out of line into the alley. his sharp, withered face lifted toward the clean, cool sky that domed San Francisco Bay. His eyes closed, his lips moved, his companions bowed their heads. The silent prayer lasted but a moment, and then all four went over, stern, aloof, resolute. So he's describing, as you see here, these four sailors that Bob's under, I'm going ashore. So his escort, Mr. Murphy, said, "Navigators," explained Mr. Murphy, "they're new too. We've got about 12 of them on the California, maybe 15, you can't tell. Today you got 12, maybe 15. Tomorrow you've got maybe 18 or 20. They're always working on the wicked, converting sinners, holding revivals, praying with lost souls. Every ship in the Navy's got some. I don't know how many in all, and they ain't saying." And so forth. He goes on in that. So I don't think we like that image too much. But you see what he said, the Chief Master of Arms, what did he say? They're always working on the wicked, converting sinners, holding revivals, praying with lost souls. So nobody in the Navy was very popular in those days. I talked to somebody just the other day who said he actually saw this sign in Newport, Rhode Island, and said, "Dogs and sailors, keep off the grass." You know, that was kind of the attitude toward them. The Christian public was slow to accept there could be any genuine Christians in the Navy. Dawson Troutman occasionally wanted to use a church auditorium for some event, and they wouldn't let him. They didn't want the sailors meeting their girls in their church in there. So our public image wasn't the greatest in front of men. But I think in front of God, you know, it's pretty good.
Jim, you had a career out
there,
didn't you?
24 years I had.
And when did you get out?
1956.
About when Doss died?
Yeah, that's what hurried up. I was negotiating with him, and then after he drowned, Lauren sent him, really put the screws on me to get out and come and help him. But I think I'll close. You've been a real attentive group, you know, really appreciate talking to you. But since Dawson Troutman's death's come up, let me tell you what happened in that. That there's a weekend conference up in Scroon Lake, New York, Upper New York, run by a very outstanding Christian named Jack Wirtson. Had a radio and TV ministry as well as camp ministry. So Jack had a speedboat, and he wanted to take Dawson for a ride. So a bunch of kids hanging around on the dock with conferees, and so Dawson said, "Well, who wants to go along?" So a bunch of crowd people rushed down. Now, it's a four-passenger boat, but they put eight people in it. You know, Jack and Dawson were in the front, and then the other seat was room for three. So, or not Jack, there's a guy named Norm Larson up with him. But three of them scooted forward on the seat, and the other three set up behind on the back. You know, so the six people on this seat, and then two up front. So Dawson, always you know, aware of what was going on, asked, he said, "Does anybody can't swim?" Well, there are two girls who didn't swim. So he said, "Well, I'll lock arms. I'll sit in the middle." So he sat in the middle on the back and locked arms with these girls that he knew they couldn't swim. I don't know why he didn't put them down at a lower level, but at least that's what they did. So as they were speeding out about a mile and a half from shore, Jack looked around at Dawson and said, "Isn't this fun? Let's go get Lotta," who was his wife. And so Dawson said, "Great." So without turning around, Jack spun the wheel on the rudder at full speed. And the lake was kind of rough, so it slapped into a wave. And when it did, Dawson and the girl on the outside of him fell overboard. Well, he knew she couldn't swim. That's the reason that he was sitting next to her. So Jack didn't think anything had happened. He threw some lifeboats over. They circled around. And when they came alongside, one of the girls in the boat was an expert swimmer, life-saving certificate. She dove over, got underneath Dawson and the girl he was holding, brought him up to the surface, and they pulled the girl aboard the boat. And then she was still holding Dawson up. He was exhausted. And for the only time in her life, she developed stomach and leg cramps and couldn't move above her waist. So in order to save her own life, she had to let him go. Well, the people that pulled Aline Beck, the girl, out of his arms, noticed that once he released her, his arms just spread apart. So he used the last ounce of energy that he had holding her up till she was rescued. And this Time magazine, it has got one good thing in it. The picture of him, the caption is, "Always holding someone up." But Billy Graham was conducting a crusade in Oklahoma City at the time this happened. So I guess the only time he's ever done this, he turned the meeting over to Grady Wilson to preach that night, and he came up and did Dawson Trotman's funeral. But he never called an accident. He said, "I think they had a meeting in heaven last night and decided it's time for Dawson to come home. But it had to be dramatic. Couldn't be any ordinary thing." I was up there at Scroon Lake at the time and never referred to as an accident. Lila Trotman was there, and the Sunday before it happened, Monday afternoon, she had a strong premonition that the next time Dawson took an overseas trip, that he was going to be lost by drowning in the water. So Sunday afternoon, she said, "There's a lot of questions about what I need to do if and when you're taken." So she took shorthand notes for 4 hours in her notebook Sunday afternoon. Well, then the next day, after they couldn't recover Dawson's body, they went back ashore to get help. I don't know just what they were looking for, but somebody's got to tell Lila. She was there at camp with her daughter Ruth, who was on a special diet, so she'd gone to a little store to get some cottage cheese for her. And on her way back to the camp, she had such a strong sense that something's going to happen, she pulled off the road and prayed that God would give her the strength to be a good testimony when it happened. So once she got the people in the boat got back, they said, "Somebody's got to tell Lila." And so this is a big camp, not everybody knew where to find her. But one girl, Dottie Anderson, said, "I know where she is. Well, you go tell her." So Dottie rushed over to her camp, to her cabin, the same time Lila was returning from the little village there. And she said, "Dawson has fallen overboard, and they haven't found him yet." And Lila said, "I know." So she was the outstanding testimony all that week, you know, in that. So I think that, you know, God was finished with him, and if there's more time, I'd tell you why I think he was finished and why he was taken home at this time. Maybe I could take 2 minutes to say that, Dawson Trotman, like all entrepreneurs, could not delegate. He held everything, a tight grip. He told me in 1953, he said, "I'm the bottleneck, the navigators." He couldn't change. He said, "I've done my job. My men are ready to take over. I'm just waiting to get out of the way." I didn't take it serious in 1953. But once he was in heaven, Lorne Sanney took over. He's the exact opposite, a team man and a great delegator. So the ministry, the navigators, almost made a vertical climb after Lorne Sanney took over. So my impression is that God was so jealous or so interested in this ministry going forward that he wouldn't even let a guy like Dawson Trotman stand in the way of that. Now, you probably don't agree with that, but that's my observation.
That 56th crusade in Oklahoma City, I just bet you a lot of you guys sitting in the room may not know it, but they go back to that crusade.
Yeah, that was
That crusade that Charlie Riggs, who was one of Dawson's disciples, were one of Lorne's.
Yeah.
When Lorne left, Charlie took over counselor training for Grant Team, disciple Gene Ward, crusade, disciple my dad, that crusade.
Well, I know Bob Potter's one of those guys. I don't know how many were in that group. But am I right that that's the only time Billy has ever turned the preaching over to somebody else in a major crusade to do something else? But he came up and spent the night in Colorado Springs to be with us up there. Well, as I said, I've talked longer than I intended. You've been a great audience. Will you take that page that says evaluation? And if you think this workshop should be repeated, why... say something favorable about it. John evaluates every year to see what he wants to repeat because there's so much material available. So So thank you very much. It's been great to be with you.